listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. In a little bit, we'll visit some cemeteries with Lauren Rhodes, but first, we talk time travel with James Glick. James Glick is my guest, and he's the author of many books on science and technology, and is so highly respected that it's difficult to believe that he's willing to be here with me, but he is. His latest book is the fascinating Time Travel, A History. James Glick, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
I'm delighted to be here, Gary.
You know, this reminds me of the time that you were a guest on my radio show, and we talked about your time travel book. Do you remember that?
In a previous life, that was.
You know, a lot of things that are science fiction in the past, they eventually came to pass. Like there was science fiction about space travel and space flight and the exploration of planets. And there was, you know, the telephones that were going to have pictures. And all of those things, they actually happened. But if time travel were ever going to be possible, wouldn't we already know? Because, as you said in your book, we'd be inundated with time travel tourists from the future.
Well, that's an idea that Stephen Hawking had. Stephen Hawking threw a party, or rather, he printed up invitations for a party, and the date on the invitation was an invitation in the past. And he said, "Party for time travelers, come, you know, to my rooms, and there's going to be free booze." And nobody showed up. And so he said, and I think his tongue is in his cheek, that this proves that time travel is impossible, because, you know, where are the time travelers?
Well, what do you think? Do you agree?
I suppose they could just, you know, be invisible. I mean, you're not a secret time traveler, are you?
Well, no, but I do, you know, I mean, one of the reasons I was drawn to your book is because, and I haven't read any of your other books, not that I don't want to, but they're not the kind of things that I normally read, but I'm, you know, just, I love the idea of time travel, and I'm fascinated by time travel, and always have been since I was a little kid. I mean, are you a time travel enthusiast?
Well, that basically, you've just explained why I wrote the book, because I love the idea of time travel, and I'm fascinated by it. And although I can't say that I'm an aficionado of the time travel stories, as I got into this project, I was reading stuff for the first time. I had never seen Doctor Who, for example. I don't know if you're a fan of Doctor Who. If we were in England and I said that I'd never seen Doctor Who, people would just laugh.
Yeah.
And I have caught up now, and it's great. I mean, I didn't like it at first, but it grew on me.
I've watched all the episodes, just not yet.
so that's how this is going to go. You know, you're proving a certain kind of point. If you're going to tell the jokes, I'll be the straight man, and I'll say what you're proving is that we're very sophisticated about time now, and we get that kind of humor, and we can tell that kind of joke, and you can tell jokes like that. We can talk about meeting ourselves in the past, and everybody knows what that's about. And time travel is so familiar to us. You know, we have time travel cartoons and time travel commercials, and time travel is basically in the wallpaper of our lives. And so the weird thing about it, and more than anything else, this is what made me think that there was going to be an interesting book here, is that it's actually a new idea. That before H.G. Wells in 1895, time travel essentially didn't exist. People couldn't imagine it. They didn't talk about it. They didn't dream of it. The kind of jokes you're telling now couldn't be told. And so at the beginning of these time travel stories, everything had to be painstakingly explained. And yet suddenly there's H.G. Wells with his machine and his time traveler hurtling 80,000 years into the future.
And he really set the template for how time travel stories would be told.
It created a beginning, and it created some of the rules. I mean, for example, one of H.G. Wells' little appreciated rules is that a time machine doesn't really need any energy. You can cheat in that way. You can't cheat in other ways. Or rather, there are a million different ways you can cheat as long as you have a certain amount of science to make it plausible. But right. he didn't worry about if his machine traveled into the future, he didn't worry about the fact that the Earth would be moving through space and that maybe the time traveler should consider the possibility that he was going to materialize in a vacuum somewhere.
Well, George Pal acknowledged that, I think, a little bit in the Time Machine movie, because you can see rocks forming over the Time Machine and then going away. And
right. Well, by the time he made the movie, 65 years after the book, everything had changed. We knew a lot more. There was a whole, there were generations of time travel books and even a few movies that he could work from. And also, Einstein had been born, and we knew all about relativity, and we started getting smart about time.
Well, I'm not a scientist, but tell me if this is some part of relativity. So I have 10 minutes to spend with a beautiful woman, and it goes by like that. And I have 10 minutes in which I'm getting my teeth drilled in the dentist chair, and it's a very long 10 minutes. Is that relativity?
I should say first, I'm not a scientist either. And second, no, that's not Einstein's version of relativity. On the other hand, he chose the word, and the word expresses a feeling, a universal feeling, which you've just described exactly. And another part of it is another way that time is relative and time is a psychological thing is in the way time passes differently depending on how old we are.
Right.
When you're a kid, a month, it's a month till Christmas. In a month, you're going to get a new bicycle. That is a lifetime. And when you're a little bit older, as I am, a month goes by in the blink of an eye.
Well, isn't that a mathematical thing? I mean, if you're 1 year old, then 1 year is 100% of your life. But for you and me, 1 year is a 60-something of our lives.
Well, that's part of it, but it doesn't that doesn't totally explain why time passes more quickly when you're having fun, as you said, and more slowly when you're getting your teeth drilled. And why when you're in prison we say you're doing time. There are lots of ways you can think about these things scientifically. It might have to do with information, that the more information that's coming at you per second, or you turn that around, it's how many seconds go by per bit of information. So if you've got a lot of information, time seems to be traveling quickly. I have a feeling that what I just said was really a lot of mumbo jumbo. Anyway, relativity is, as you know, it's a different thing, and it's equally real. It's just real in a different domain of our experience. And one thing about that Einstein discovered, he hypothesized this, but has absolutely proven to be true, is that if you travel close to the speed of light on your rocket ship, time travels more slowly for you. Time slows down. And likewise, if you travel in a profound gravitational field, such as near a black hole, time slows down. And these are ideas that were used, if any of this is ringing a bell, if you saw the movie Interstellar a couple of years ago, they used both of these ideas to try to legitimize some of their storytelling. But it's true. And it's measurably true. And when the astronaut returned from the space station a couple of years ago, it was computed that he was now a few milliseconds younger than he would have been if he had stayed home.
Right.
Even though orbiting the Earth hundreds of times, he had lived through that many extra days.
Yeah, so he should have been older.
Yeah, there are a lot of paradoxes in the time business.
Oh, that brings me to one of my favorite time travel stories that you didn't mention in your book. And you do mention tons of them, and that was fun, but I want to bring up all the ones you didn't mention. Why not?
Please do.
Okay, so one of my favorites is Superman number 141 from 1960. It's called Superman's Return to Krypton. And Superman is flying at super speed. He's chasing a creature or something. And he flies back in time and lands on Krypton, the planet from where he was originally from. As everybody knows, that he was blasted off of Krypton when Krypton exploded when he was a baby. So now he's gone back in time to before his parents were married, and he's landed on Krypton, and he loses his powers because he's back on Krypton where he doesn't have powers. And so naturally he wants to save Krypton and save his parents. But immediately my little mind said, well, he can't, because if he were to save Krypton, then Krypton didn't explode, then he wouldn't be rocketed to Earth as a baby. He would not grow up to be Superman. He wouldn't fly back in time to save Krypton. And therefore, Krypton would explode, and he would be rocketed to Earth as a baby, and then he would fly back to Krypton and save it, but then he wouldn't be rocketed to Earth as a baby.
Now, wait, are you saying you figured all this out, or this was part of the episode?
No, this is me just going nuts with it.
All right, well, good for you. And, of course, we all know that what you discovered in your precocious youth was the grandfather paradox. And it's the essential paradox of time travel, and it's a paradox that comes up as soon as you start to think about what happens if you can travel back in time and alter the past. And there are a lot of versions of this paradox, but the reason we call it the grandfather paradox, took me a while to discover this, but I traced it back to a letter that a kid, a precocious kid, presumably much like yourself, wrote to one of the early pulp fiction magazines that was publishing time travel stories in the 1920s. And this kid wrote, well, suppose I can travel back in time, let me say 200 years, and I visit the homestead of my great-great-great-grandfather, and I am thus enabled to shoot him while he is still a young man and as yet unmarried. From this it will be noted that I could have prevented my own birth. Philosophical ideas about causality that philosophers deal with, not, maybe not by telling stories, but by playing with words. But they have to deal with some of the same puzzles. What does it mean when we say that something in the past is the cause of something in the future? It's not as simple as it seems, and that's why the time travel stories get so complicated.
The whole what-if aspect of time travel stories.
Yeah, and I love these paradoxes, and there's so many versions of them. I don't know if you remember, this is fair because you're giving me examples that aren't in my book. I don't know if you remember the movie 12 Monkeys with Bruce Willis.
Sure.
Which is based on a great, great, much less well-known French film, La Jetée, which is only a half hour by the great filmmaker Chris Marker. And in both of these, the twist at the end is the same. And so if our listeners don't want me to spoil, they should just close their ears for a second.
I think you can spoil. It's been like 25 years. You can go ahead.
All right. Well, our hero, the time traveler, our protagonist, has these visions from when he was a child of seeing a man die that keep flashing back to him. And at the end of the story, we discover that the man whose death he's witnessed is himself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, it's bad. And now that I've said it, our listeners have to be puzzled, but it's even more puzzling when you watch the movie, but it's great. It's this kind of, I get a real pleasure from these twists, along with the confusion.
There was a television show when I was a kid that just like drove me crazy, and that was The Time Tunnel, in which these two time travelers were like Billy Pilgrim, unstuck in time, and they kept bouncing from one place to another. But they never landed anywhere normal. I mean, wherever they landed, it was the deck of the Titanic or in the middle of the Little Bighorn battlefield. And they never just landed in Cleveland on, you know, on April 3rd, you know, 1905 or something. It was something.
That's another part of the fun of time travel. It's another sort of subgenre When H.G. Wells invented time travel, he just sent his time traveler into the future. But very quickly, people started going back into the past and exploring history. And so time travel becomes a way of telling stories about history. I guess I don't remember that time tunnel show, but what I remember from when I was a kid was in the old Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons, there was Sherman and Mr. Peabody. Mr. Peabody is the dog, as I recall. And
Sherman is his boy.
His pet boy, right. And they have the Wayback Machine. And they go back and watch William Tell shoot the arrow off. Does he shoot the arrow, or does he get the arrow shot off his head?
Yeah, he shoots the arrow, right. But Mr. Peabody always, you know, saved the day. The history would not have happened if Peabody hadn't been there to make it happen.
Exactly, right. And it's always, it's never right. I mean, it's comic history. It's, it's Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Right. Gary Shapiro, this is From the Bookshelf. We're talking with James Glick. He's the author of Time Travel, A History. Well, James Glick, if you could travel in time, or would you go forward or backward?
Ooh, well, that's a question that I started putting to people as part of my research. And I have to say, when I started working on the book, I just assumed that everybody would want to go forward. I wanted to go forward. For me, I guess time travel is about the future. It certainly was that for H.G. Wells. It was a kind of futurism. We think about wonders of technology and how wonderful, even as I say this to you now, I'm aware that it's less and less true every year, that actually we don't fantasize as much about the future as people used to. And that's weird in itself. I mean, that's in a way troubling, that in the year 1900, everybody was incredibly excited thinking about what great technologies were going to arrive by the year 2000. There were going to be flying cars, boats that could travel underwater. Maybe there would even be space travel. But as I recall the year 2000, people weren't talking very much about the year 2100. And if we do talk about the future now, we tend to be scared of it, most of our futuristic fiction is dystopian. And so, yeah, lots of people would rather travel back into the past and learn about history and maybe place themselves in the past and be a part of history. So I'm a little more of two minds about it now than I was when I started on the book.
Well, when I was reading your book, Time Travel, A History, I realized that the future today holds anxiety and the past holds nostalgia. So I think, unlike most people, I want to go back into the past. Like you were saying, there are visions of the future. Especially now when there's recently, we've undergone extreme weather conditions and strange political turnings and things like that. It's much more pleasant. I mean, even some of the right-wing political fury is asking to go back to a simpler time, so to speak.
Well, it's true. Nostalgia is a tricky thing. And we have nostalgia for a past that never really existed, that exists only in our imagination. I think that's been a contributor. But here's another paradox. Is it possible to have nostalgia for the future? I'm starting to miss the visions of the future that existed when I was a kid.
Well, I have some friends who say the reason that our generation was so disillusioned and cynical is because when we were growing up, we saw the Jetsons and Star Trek and all these things that were going to happen, and then they haven't happened, and now we're pissed off.
Yeah, it gets worse and worse. It's 2017 now. I think it's fair to say that just about all of us would rather be in a different year.
Well, there's this whole other aspect of your book about moving forward in time, moving backward in time, a whole examination of the meaning and the definition of time.
Well, that's true. And I have to say, years and years ago, when I told my editor I was thinking about writing a book about time travel, he thought for a minute, and I wasn't sure he was happy about that idea. And then he said, well, you know, it's really going to be a book about time. And that turned out to be correct. I mean, it's not a treatise about time. It's a kind of backward or twisted way of examining some difficult questions about time. I've written, before this, most of my books were about science in one way or another, and I've written about the physics of time before. And I wanted to write about time maybe in a more complex way than even a scientist would, because time is more for us than what it is for a physicist. It's one thing when you're making mathematical models of the universe. It's another thing when you're wondering about psychology and philosophy and causation and about consciousness and memory. And so these are all issues that I realized were being explored by time travel stories. And I hope that by writing about these stories, I'd be able to explore them a little bit too.
If at some point in the future I were to die, I don't think that's ever going to happen, but if it should, would time still go on without me?
I've got bad news for you, Gary.
Yes?
There isn't much we can say about the future with certainty, but the one thing we can say is that we're going to die.
Oh, and, no.
Yeah, and really that's what time travel is for in the end, isn't it? It's a way of avoiding that. It's a way of gaining a kind of immortality. It's a way of resisting time's inevitable effects upon us. And it's another kind of paradox that when you look at our lifespans, we know that there's a time before we existed, and we know that there's going to be a time after we have stopped existing. And for one reason or another, most of us, at least, are a lot more comfortable with the first thing. You know, I don't feel any pain about all of the centuries that went by without my being there, but it's hard to think about the time after we're here without at least feeling maybe a kind of anticipatory grief.
Thus, the anxiety of the future and the nostalgia for the past.
Yeah. And so that's what time travel does for us. It lets us escape.
It's a very fascinating book, and it's called Time Travel, A History, and the author, my guest, James Glick, thank you so much for spending some time talking with us about it.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Lauren Rhodes is the author of several books about cemeteries, including her newest, a sort of coffee table travel book called 199 Cemeteries to See Before You Die. That's a funny title. Lauren Rhodes, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
I think there are a lot of us cemetery fans out there.
You know, it surprises me because when I first started doing this, I was really kind of self-conscious, and I didn't, you know, afraid to tell people that I hung out in cemeteries, but I keep meeting more and more that are interested in it.
What do you think is the lure, say, of a cemetery?
Different things for different people. You know, some people are interested in genealogy, and so, you know, they're mostly interested in family graves, but other people are interested in history or artwork. Cemeteries have some amazing, one-of-a-kind sculptures. Some people like to go and see the landscaping. Other people are bird watchers. So it's a really wide selection of people.
You mentioned the artwork. I saw this incredible cemetery with Kathy Colewitz's sculptures at the German Soldiers' Cemetery in Belgium. Have you been there?
No, I have been through Belgium, but I've never stopped to look at the cemetery.
200 cemeteries to see before you die.
Well, it could easily have been 500.
Who do you travel with when you go to these cemeteries? Someone of a like mind, or are they like, oh, another cemetery?
A little both. My daughter is a teenager, and she's very long-suffering. You know, last year we were in Spain, France, and England, and saw cemeteries in every country. And, you know, she puts up with it. She can always find a stray cat, or if they're bunnies or deer or something like that, she can always find something to entertain herself with. Pretty much I drag people along everywhere I go. If you know me, sooner or later you're going to end up in a cemetery with me.
My wife is the same way, actually. She's an artist, and she always uses, you know, like terrible things in her artwork. She's always dragging me to wherever anybody has died in agony. That's where she wants to go. So.
A kindred spirit.
Yeah, yeah. But I enjoy it. I really do. I have some favorite cemeteries, and I'm sure you do. What are some of your all-time favorites?
I think the one that started me out is, I keep coming back to it as my favorite, that's Highgate in London. Highgate is up on a high hill looking down on the city, and it's just opulent and completely overgrown. It was abandoned for, I don't know, several years in the 70s. Before the Friends of Highgate Cemetery took it over. And they're kind of taking care of it as a managed woodland now. It's only the, let's see, there are two sides of it, and one side is only open to tours with the Friends. And the paths are overgrown, and it's just lush and green and gorgeous. And I've been there, I think, three times and still not seen all there is to see. But you have a really pretty cemetery in Santa Cruz, the Evergreen Cemetery, kind of back up against the mountains, lots of history there, and the historical museum takes care of that one, as I remember. I've been on tours there a couple of times. So, I find cemeteries everywhere I go, and the favorites change in rank, I think, but some days I a big fan of the artwork. Rock Creek in Washington, D.C. is gorgeous and full of statuary. Some days it's the, if I think about spring, I think about Swan Point Cemetery in Providence. Just amazing old trees. I happened to be there in May a couple of years ago, and I never saw a weeping cherry tree as gorgeous as the one I saw there. So, lots of favorites.
Do you... are you drawn to certain graves? Are you, like, looking for... I mean, my father is buried in a cemetery in Los Angeles where there are a lot of famous people, and people come there looking for the Three Stooges. just so happens that Curly and Shemp are buried there.
Oh, that's amazing. Which one is that?
It's Home of Peace.
Home of Peace.
Yeah, in Los Angeles, yeah. And there's also another... a famous one in Los Angeles, the Hillside Cemetery, where Al Jolson and...
Yes, I've been to that one.
Yeah, and Leonard Nimoy recently joined the ranks.
Oh, there. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I'm planning a pilgrimage in October. I'm going to be down doing a book tour in Southern California. One of the places I want to stop is the Forest Lawn in Hollywood Hills.
Mm-hmm.
Where Carrie Fisher is buried.
A very famous one.
Yeah, yeah. She was a huge influence on me.
Carrie Fisher was?
Yes. I never had the opportunity to meet her, but I discovered Star Wars at just the right age, and it changed my life.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're talking with Lauren Rhodes. She's the author of 199 Cemeteries to See Before You Die. Lauren Rhodes, I know that your book, 199 Cemeteries to See Before You Die, mentions the pyramids. What about other tombs? Like, what about Lenin's tomb or Grant's tomb?
I haven't been to Lenin's. I would really very much like to go. But I did go to Grant's tomb, probably 15 years ago now, just because I read somewhere that it was the largest mausoleum in the United States. So I was on a pilgrimage. I had to see it.
They've recently fixed it up. I don't know if it's within the last 15 years. It's very nice.
I was amazed. And we had it pretty much to ourselves, which was interesting. You know, with all my research, millions of people used to go, and now it's, you know, several people a day, I think, but not anywhere near the same amount.
At the time of his death, I believe there was like a competition to see who could get, you know, be able to have Grant's tomb in their city, and then New York won, and they were really thrilled. But then, you know, subsequently, Grant's popularity dimmed in historical view, and then it fell on hard times, the tomb. That's sad. But, you know, it is interesting to see, like, at the cemetery I was mentioning before, Hillside Cemetery, when Al Jolson died, he was a huge star. He had just been in two successful films. He wasn't in them, but his voice was in them, The Jolson Story and Jolson Sings Again. And they built this enormous, you know, statue and a monument to him. Whereas when George Jessel, who was a contemporary of Jolson's, when Jessel died, he was an old man and hardly remembered, and there's just a little tiny plaque there.
The same with Hollywood Forever. It was the place to be buried in the 20s and 30s, and even, you know, into the first half of the 20th century. So Fairbanks has got this huge monument with a 200-foot reflecting pool, and I don't know that his movies are watched very much anymore. Cecil B. DeMille, you know, who was so influential, has a little bench, you know.
Yeah, I guess it depends on when you die and what people think of you when you die.
And, yeah.
I mean, in Russia...
Oh, I think there's something to be said for dying at the height of your fame, you know.
Like Valentino or something like that.
Yeah. Well, even Valentino has a slot in the mausoleum. So and, you know, in terms of tombs, it's not grand. Marilyn Monroe's grave is not very grand, but it's probably the most visited place in Los Angeles.
Wow. And you have a beautiful picture in your book of Jimi Hendrix's monument.
Oh, it's fabulous. And it's not a cemetery that's near to anything. It's a little country cemetery outside of Seattle. I had some friends up there that I said, you know, we're coming up to visit. I'd really like to see Jimi Hendrix's grave. And that led to a whole conversation.
Oh, goody.
I don't know what I'm going to tell the people I work with, because I'm not going to tell them I spent the weekend in a graveyard. But it is amazing to see. And the nice story about all of that is, I'm going to blank on his name, but the one that founded the Experience Music Museum in Seattle helped the family get the rights to Hendrix's music back, and so that's how the grave was paid for. Originally, Jimmy had just a plaque in the ground, and once they got the publishing rights to his music back, they could afford to build this spectacular tomb.
Well, that's a heartwarming story, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think about when you're in a cemetery, do you ever think about your own eventual resting place?
Well, I have it picked out. I haven't figured out how I'm going to afford it yet. But I'd like to be buried in the Columbarium in San Francisco. I don't know if you know the history of the cemeteries in San Francisco, but they were evicted and dug up and moved in the 1940s. The city passed a law in 1901 that banned burial in anywhere in San Francisco. And the cemeteries fought it for decades before they finally lost the final court case. Excuse me. And the only thing that's left now is this spectacular, Baroque, Columbarium that's owned by the Neptune Society. That's I think it's 5 stories tall, and some of the most influential founding families have their urns there. But they've added a whole bunch of new mausoleum, columbarium hallways, and it's got stained glass. It's just gorgeous. So that's my hope, that after my death I can stay in San Francisco.
Well, it might be cheaper than staying in San Francisco. Where I'm still
paying rent. Exactly.
But there are cemeteries where your time there expires. That wasn't Jim Morrison having a problem with his, I mean, not him personally because he doesn't care, but they were threatening to move him out of where he is buried.
And Père Lachaise, I didn't realize, because so many of the family tombs date back to the founding of the cemetery, the early 19th century, but Hendrix had a lease that expired, I want to say in the early 2000s. And there was a lot of talk about sending him on his way because his fans have been so disruptive to the cemetery. They've done a lot of damage with, you know, graffiti and just the number of people that visit. But again, his grave is one of the most visited tourist sites in Paris. So in the end, there was an accommodation reached between the estate and the cemetery. So now, I haven't been in several years. I don't know what they have in the way of security. But for a while, they did have a full-time guard that stood over his grave and made sure people didn't do any damage.
When I visited Lenin's tomb, that was in the days of the Soviet Union, and it's like a vault. It's a really thick, you know, thing. And there's like armed guards at the door, and then at the first landing, and then on the doorway as you enter.
Wow.
You know, and it's like it's really well, guarded, even though, you know, he's already dead.
Was that one of those places where you're on a conveyor belt so they can keep everybody moving through?
They do keep you moving through pretty quick.
I didn't end up including him in the book, but I added, I'm no doubt going to mangle it because my Russian is terrible, but Novodevichy, was a convent cemetery, but Gorbachev, all kinds of people are buried there.
Yeah, Khrushchev is there also, right? And
and the sculpture looks amazing.
There's a beautiful grave there of Chekhov, the playwright, not the Star Trek.
With a seagull on it.
That's right. Yeah, this beautiful seagull that comes up out of it. That's beautiful. What about battlefields like Gettysburg or Little Bighorn?
I added both of those. And I was interested, as I read about Little Bighorn, you were talking earlier about places where the historical view has changed over time. That's one of those places where originally the U.S. signed a treaty with I don't know how many Indian tribes, Native American tribes, and then there was gold found. And so America came back and said, oh, we know we have a treaty with you, but all we need now is just space across your land. And it doesn't have to be much. It just needs to be as wide as a wagon will span. And, of course, the natives said, no, you gave us this land. You signed the treaty. And so Custer went out and made some bad choices, attacked before he was prepared, figuring that the natives weren't very well armed and they could just sweep in there and do what they wanted, and that didn't turn out very well for him. But the history of the graveyard was amazing. As I researched it, the bodies were just left on the field, and when the second column came up several days after the battle, they didn't have much time, they didn't have many supplies, and they weren't really prepared to recover all the bodies, so they pretty much just threw dirt over them. Custer was buried at a reasonable depth, but most of the men were not, and so, of course, as soon as the army pulled out, the animals moved in, and so bones were scattered all over everywhere. So it was a course of several attempts to go and find all the people that were buried on the battlefield. The natives came and took their warriors away, and the different tribes all had different ways of dealing with their dead. so they, there weren't any Native bodies left on the battlefield. It was just Americans. But, you know, for a while it was sanctified ground, and then over the years, the other side of the story has started to be told, and now it's recorded there in the battlefield. There's the National Cemetery where the U.S. soldiers are buried, and then the several different places where the Native history is honored. And I just found that really interesting, that the place hasn't changed. It's just our conception of this has changed over the years.
Which makes me think of the African burial ground in Manhattan, where previously it was a parking lot or a building, and now it's recognized as the burial ground for thousands of slaves.
It's an amazing sight. When I was there in 2002, you know, obviously the 9/11 disaster had taken over public money and public thought in New York. I mean, that goes without saying. But in 2002, the African burial ground was a patch of green grass with a chain link fence around it. And there were signs up around that part of Manhattan that designated the borders of the burial ground, you know, with blocks and blocks, but it just had buildings built on it. And the space would never have been rediscovered until they broke ground to build a new federal building. And once they got down 20 feet, suddenly they were turning up bones. So, you know, it was a case of when the Dutch had control of Manhattan, they didn't distinguish. The Africans were buried with the Dutch. There wasn't any segregation. Once the Americans took over Manhattan, their Africans were originally buried in St. Paul's Churchyard and down at Trinity. And then the laws were changed so that they couldn't be buried in graveyards with whites. So that's when the African burial ground first came into use, and it was used for years. During the Revolutionary War, the British used it as a dump and also to bury some of their prisoners. So not everyone buried in the African burial ground is actually of African descent. But the land was abandoned at a certain point and then used as a dump and then sold as lots. So houses were built on it, and then those were followed by buildings and eventually skyscrapers. And, you know, there are something like 200 burial grounds, I think, in Manhattan alone, but I may be wrong about that, but 200 burial grounds that have been abandoned over the years. And it amazes me that people can forget about things like that. Once it gets to be a kind of derelict plot of ground, if there aren't big permanent markers, then people move in and use it for other things.
I know that.
But now, as you say, that's a really nice spot. The artwork that the monument that remembers the Africans is beautiful. And there's a little museum that talks about their contributions to building Manhattan. It's really a wonderful place.
Yeah, there's also always a ranger on duty there who'll tell you fascinating stories.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's great. You know, it's just amazing. I mean, we just sort of skimmed the surface of, we didn't talk about 199 cemeteries yet.
It was so hard to limit it to 199.
Well, maybe there'll be a volume two then.
That would be 199
more cemeteries.
Exactly. Well, somebody has pointed out that you can see the 199, but it's the 200th one you have to worry about. So.
That's right. or not worry. Or you wouldn't. I wouldn't.
Right.
You wouldn't have to worry at all. Depends on how you feel about such things. Well, this book is called 199 Cemeteries to See Before You Die, and the author, my guest, Lauren Rhodes. Lauren, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guests, James Glick. He's the author of Time Travel, A History, and Lauren Rhodes. Her book is called 199 Cemeteries to See Before You Die. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.